Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's joint meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and Planned Parenthood, brought to you from the Commonwealth Club offices overlooking San Francisco's Financial District. I am Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club. It is also my pleasure to welcome the listeners of public radio stations around the country joining us for America's longest-running radio program. At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker. President Bill Clinton has said of this congressman that not only has he represented New York well, he has also represented the United States very well. Now serving his fourth full term in the House of Representatives, he represents New York's 8th Congressional District, which has often been referred to as one of the most demographically diverse districts in the nation. The eclectic district includes most of Manhattan's West Side, as well as Brooklyn, and he has been elected to Congress in 1992 after serving for 16 years in the New York State Assembly. Our speaker has emerged as a national leader on civil rights, civil liberties, transportation, and a host of progressive issues such as access to health care, support for the arts, and the expansion of the Social Security system. He was reelected in 1998 with a resounding 86% of the vote. Our speaker today is perhaps best known as a prominent member of the House Judiciary Committee. There, along with his role in defending individual rights and religious freedoms, the congressman was a vigorous defender of the Constitution during the presidential impeachment hearings. His unwavering demand for bipartisan adherence to the Constitution earned him national praise. Within the Judiciary Committee, he is the ranking member on the Subcommittee on Commercial and Administrative Law, which has jurisdiction over key issues such as consumer protection, bankruptcy law, and the right to competent legal representation. He's also a member of the Constitution Subcommittee, which considers all proposed constitutional amendments and deals with such issues as constitutional rights, federal civil rights laws, abortion, gay rights, and government ethics. As such, he has been a principal participant in some of the great ideological debates of our time on issues ranging from abortion to internet free speech rights. A well-regarded source of political opinion and policy expertise, our speaker has been featured on a wide spectrum of news outlets, including NBC's Meet the Press, CNN's Larry King Live, and PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He has been a reliable commentator for virtually all of the major print organizations around the nation, from the New York Times to the Detroit Times to the LA Times. From George to Vanity Fair, from liberal columnist Lars Eric Nelson to moderate David Broder to conservative Robert Novak. How's that for a broad spectrum? Our speaker is a graduate of Crown Heights, Stuyvesant High School, Columbia University, where he was a Pulitzer Prize scholar, and Fordham Law School. He also lives at this point on the west side of Manhattan with his wife Joyce and son Michael. And I understand he is an avid New York Yankees fan. It is my honor to present to you U.S. Representative from New York, Gerald Nadler.
Thank you very much. I should mention, since you did, that I became an avid Yankees fan when I was 4 years old and saw a commercial with Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Yogi Berra, and Phil Rizzuto, all appearing on that commercial for Coca-Cola. And if you want to figure out my age, you can figure the 1 year when those four were all in the Yankees together. I want to thank you very much. I want to give many thanks to Skip Rhodes and the Commonwealth Club, and to Skip Rhodes for that wonderful introduction, to the Commonwealth Club for having me here today. I also want to thank Jenna Daneler of the Jewish Community Relations Council, San Francisco, and Diane Harrison and Therese Wilson of Planned Parenthood Golden Gate for serving as the official sponsors. Also, I want to thank Judson True of the Commonwealth Club and the Raoul Wallenberg Jewish Democratic Club and the Alice B. Toklas Gay and Lesbian Democratic Club, which also, I understand, have roles in this today. I am very glad to be here today in San Francisco. It's often said that New Yorkers feel most at home in San Francisco. That has certainly been my experience. This town, with its culture, diversity, and energy, is very much like the communities that I represent. The west side of Manhattan, Greenwich Village, and downtown, as well as the Brooklyn communities of Coney Island, Brighton Beach, Bensonhurst, and Borough Park. We are both vibrant coastal communities and centers of arts and culture. We both have important and active Jewish and gay and lesbian communities, and we undoubtedly have the two greatest Chinatowns in the United States. Our cities have some of the most impressive bridges in all the world. And of course, in my humble opinion, San Francisco and New York send some of the best people to Washington. Hopefully, come November, California will be sending both Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer back to the Senate. And New York will finally catch up with California in sending a woman to the Senate to join them. After spending a little more time here in the city, I'm going to be traveling south to Los Angeles for the Democratic National Convention. I think now more than ever, the difference between the parties on issues such as civil liberties and civil rights could not be more starkly contrasted. Yes, I think it's certainly a nice gesture on the part of the Republicans to give airtime, speech time, face time at the convention to Colin Powell, to a gay congressman, Jim Colby, and to a rabbi to address an audience consisting of 97% white delegates at their convention. Much like their convention, it certainly looks good that George Bush visited the NAACP a month ago and that he met with the log cabin Republicans, that he deigned to meet with the log cabin Republicans. Their whole convention was designed to look more like a Democratic Party affair than a Republican event. I will give the Republicans this. After many years of extremist rhetoric, they've certainly finally learned to talk the talk on some issues and to muzzle their extremists, at least when the cameras are around. But we must get beyond the words and symbolic gestures. In this very city in 1984, former Governor Mario Cuomo, New York Governor Mario Cuomo, said, "We must get the American public to look past the glitter, beyond the showmanship, to the reality, the hard substance of things. And we'll do it not so much with speeches that will bring people to their feet as with speeches that bring people to their senses." Civil liberties is one of those areas where we really have to look at the hard substance of things. I report to you that the state of civil liberties in the United States today, in the year 2000, is a fragile one. With the Supreme Court willing to undermine constitutional protections for individual liberties and to limit Congress' ability to legislate remedies, coupled with a congressional majority that is completely hostile to most of the civil liberties agenda in the first place, the picture is fairly bleak. Nevertheless, I'm confident that with some hard work on our collective part, we can turn the tide and successfully pursue the ideals of justice that we all hold dear. To understand the current state of things, we must review a bit of history. The history of liberty in our country is largely a history of struggle to broaden the understanding of the meaning of the stirring assertion in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. When those words were written, they certainly were not understood to mean people of African ancestry who were excluded from the political community because they were deemed to be property, not human beings. They certainly did not include women who were not allowed to vote or participate in the professions and were subject to the almost absolute control of their husbands or fathers. They certainly did not include Native Americans or gays and lesbians and bisexual or transgender people. Over time, sustained struggle has broadened the understanding of just who is equal. The Civil War and Civil War amendments of the 19th century and the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act of the 20th broadened the concept to include African Americans and all people regardless of race. The suffrage movement of the late 19th and early 20th centuries and the feminist movement of the last 40 years led to a constitutional amendment, several statutes, and many judicial rulings that broadened the concept to include women. Obviously, the struggles for racial equality and women's rights are still far from won. But the concept has been victorious. Everyone today at least pays lip service to racial and sexual equality. It is no longer acceptable in polite society or in serious political discourse to assert a belief in racial or sexual inequality. And that is half the battle. Only with respect to sexual orientation do we still have to fight for recognition of the fundamental concept that a group of people is entitled to the same rights as everyone else. Dred Scott could not be written today, but Bowers versus Hardwick was decided only a few years ago. But the course of history in the United States is clear, a long-term evolution toward greater equality and broader liberty. But this evolution has not followed a straight line. It has taken a meandering path, nudged or shoved in the right direction when people, through courageous individual and collective action, have demanded that both government and society recognize the absolute value of rights and liberties that we sometimes take for granted, and meandering in the wrong direction when people have been complacent or in times of crisis, frightened. Sometimes it has been up to state and local governments to define the contours of liberty. At other times, the federal government has been the guarantor of liberty. At all times, in between, both federal and state courts have been involved in defining and either extending or restricting liberty. At times of crisis in our history, liberties taken for granted have been curtailed by all levels of government and the infringements approved by the courts. At other times, bold people, sometimes at the margin of polite political discourse, have challenged the infringements and secured expanded freedoms for all of us. During and after the American Revolution, the newly independent citizens of the United States looked to their state governments as the repositories of their civil liberties. Many state constitutions written between 1776 and 1783 contained specific protections of these rights, state bills of rights. The threat to individual liberty was seen to be lurking in a powerful national government, which was viewed as further removed from the people and which might strip states and local governments of control over various aspects of social and political life. So when the U.S. Constitution was presented to the 13 states for ratification in 1787, many state ratification conventions conditioned their ratifications on the promise that when the new federal government was put into effect, the new Congress would immediately propose constitutional amendments containing a federal Bill of Rights. James Madison shepherded 12 amendments through the first Congress in 1789, 10 of which were quickly ratified by the states and became our hallowed Bill of Rights. As understood in the late 18th century, the federal Bill of Rights placed limits only on the federal government in its relationship with American citizens. It placed no limits or responsibilities on the states themselves. Thus, if a state did not have a Bill of Rights in its constitution or a law protecting certain of its own citizens' rights, it was assumed that a state had every right to limit free speech or to establish a state religion or to seize a person's belongings without a warrant. In fact, some states did have established churches well into the first half of the 19th century. It was not until the 20th century, long after the amendments added to the Constitution after the Civil War defined national citizenship and placed some limits on state powers, that the federal Bill of Rights was held to be binding upon state and local governments by the Warren Court. As history has shown, a written Bill of Rights, although supposedly expressing our highest values, is only as strong as the populace that demands its enforcement. Over the course of our history, Congress has, sad to say, often used its powers to stifle unpopular speech, particularly during times of war and other foreign crises. Laws aimed at crushing labor unions by limiting their freedom of speech, assembly, and association stayed on the books for far too long. Laws punishing criticism of the draft during World War I were not struck down for years after the damage had been done. Laws passed at the height of the anti-communist hysteria of the 40s and 50s, the Smith Act, the McCarran Act, destroyed many people's lives and careers. House and Senate committees chaired by demagogues like Martin Dies and Joseph McCarthy came close to making free speech synonymous with treason for a limited time. The executive branch has also abused its powers to suppress civil rights, anti-war, and labor activists, and to prosecute unpopular minority groups. The herding of Japanese Americans into detention camps during World War II and the FBI's COINTELPRO operation against civil rights and anti-war activists immediately come to mind. During some of these eras, however, the federal judiciary has stepped in and protected civil liberties against legislative and executive encroachment. Justices Louis Brandeis, William Douglas, Earl Warren, William Brennan, and Thurgood Marshall reminded us time and again of the fundamental principles behind the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment. These principles include the right to privacy in one's own home and one's own bedroom, the right to espouse one's views or engage in artistic expression, even if those views and expressions are unpopular or offensive to many people. The courts have also stepped in to protect the right to due process and the right to full, fair, and open criminal proceedings and trials, the right to be protected against overreaching searches by police or federal agents, and the right to equal treatment under the law. The federal government has often been in the forefront in protecting the rights of minorities and women in the workplace, in the housing market, in the classroom, and in government itself. Laws such as the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act, the Education Amendments of 1972, and the Violence Against Women Act remain as testaments to a progressive notion of liberty. These laws prohibit corporations, individuals, institutions, and state and local governments from interfering with the full participation in our society of members of various minority groups, whether that interference is affected by harassment, discrimination, exclusion from the benefits of society, or violence. These laws have opened the door to the federal courthouse and enabled the federal government and individuals to enforce constitutional rights. But the federal government has not completed the job. For instance, federal law does not prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Yet local governments in New York City and San Francisco, for example, have enacted strong laws which expressly prohibit such discrimination and provide severe sanctions for those who discriminate. The lesson is that no branch of government at any level can be trusted to be the sole guarantor of liberty. Only a system of checks and balances, coupled with the activism of a courageous and vigilant people, can safeguard our liberties. The federal government should act as a guarantor of fundamental rights, with the federal courts acting as a check on the political branches at the national and local level. Unfortunately, in recent years, the federal government, and especially the judiciary, has failed adequately to protect individual rights. The Supreme Court has become decidedly activist in the area of civil liberties, in the wrong direction. Determined not only to undo those rights protected by the Constitution as interpreted by earlier Supreme Courts, but also to undermine the ability of Congress to step in and protect legislatively what the Court refuses to protect constitutionally. In a series of decisions, the Court has exalted states' rights over individual rights. It has taken a newly expansive view of the rights of states, ruling, for example, that a citizen is barred by the 11th Amendment from suing a state employer for paying less than the minimum wage or for violating the age discrimination laws. The Court has limited the power of Congress to act through legislation to protect individual rights by narrowing congressional power under the Commerce Clause and under the Enforcement Clause of the 14th Amendment. The Court has even gone so far as to violate the separation of powers by asserting that Congress has not found sufficient or appropriately convincing facts to support enactment of certain legislation. The Court's substitution of its own judgment for that of Congress as a finder of fact is a breathtaking assertion of judicial power. Let me illustrate these recent trends with a few examples. While the Supreme Court has done a fairly good job of preventing excessive entanglement of church and state, it has severely weakened the protection for the exercise of religious freedom by minority religious groups. In the 1990 Smith case, the Court, with the stroke of a pen, undid decades of precedent in this area. Previously, a state could not enforce a law prohibiting a religious practice unless it could show that prohibiting that practice was the least restrictive way of satisfying a compelling state interest, the so-called strict scrutiny standard. Under Smith, all a state has to show in order to prohibit a religious practice is that there is a is that prohibiting that practice bears a rational relationship to a legitimate, not a compelling, a legitimate state interest. This much lower standard eliminates, for all practical purposes, the constitutional protection for minority religious practices. Indeed, the court's opinion said that minority religious groups would have to look to legislative bodies to protect their rights. This is standing the First Amendment on its head. The whole point of the Bill of Rights is that our fundamental freedoms are not supposed to be dependent on any majority vote. They are supposed to be ours by right, no matter how unpopular or how despised we or any group may be. Congress responded to this in 1993 with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which we know affectionately as RFRA, relying on its power to enact legislation to enforce the 14th Amendment. The act restored by legislation the old strict scrutiny standard that had been the law for decades. Congress believed that if the court would not read the Constitution to require the government to meet the highest legal standard before interfering with the free exercise of religion, Congress could mandate use of that highest standard. Congress acting in this way is nothing new. For example, when the court decided that the use of English literacy tests for voting was perfectly constitutional, an unhappy Congress, relying on its power to enforce the 14th Amendment, passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which prohibited literacy tests for voting. In the 1997 Borney case, however, the court declared RFRA unconstitutional. It held that Congress cannot rely on its power to enact legislation to enforce the 14th Amendment to fashion a remedy beyond what the court had said was required. Of course, this was exactly what Congress had done in banning literacy tests. So besides nullifying the protection of religious freedom provided by RFRA, this ruling fundamentally undercuts the constitutional basis for such critical civil rights legislation as the Voting Rights Act, for example. The court in Burney also stated that Congress lacked a sufficient factual basis to enact RFRA, despite the fact that a substantial record of violations of individual rights as a result of the Smith decision had been made by numerous witnesses in congressional hearings. This is a prime example of the court's assertion of its power to overrule congressional findings of fact. Supreme Court attacks on the Commerce Clause have also undercut the ability of Congress to fashion civil rights remedies and to enact laws to protect public health and welfare. I'm sure that many of you recall that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was upheld as constitutional on the theory that discrimination in public accommodations was a substantial burden on interstate commerce, which Congress had the authority to remedy through its power to regulate interstate commerce. However, starting with its 1995 Lopez decision, a 5-4 majority of the court has begun narrowing in case after case Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. In Lopez, the court declared unconstitutional a law to protect our children from gun violence in schools. In United States versus Morrison, the same 5-4 majority struck down a part of the Violence Against Women Act that allowed women to recover damages from their attackers. This emerging line of cases threatens not only our civil rights laws, but also our wage and hour laws, worker safety laws, and a host of other legal protections that Americans have taken for granted for generations. The court, it seems, is moving backward to the days before the New Deal, when all economic protections were declared unconstitutional as beyond the power of Congress to enact, or as violative of a so-called freedom of contract. There have also been a number of decisions in which fundamental rights survived by only the narrowest of margins, making it clear that we must look to the next election to ensure that our fragile hold on some of our fundamental liberties is protected. In its last term, the Supreme Court decided 20 cases by a 5-4 vote, the highest proportion of cases decided so narrowly in recent terms. In Stenberg versus Carhart, for example, a Nebraska anti-abortion law which would have criminalized certain types of abortions at any point during pregnancy, even pre-viability, under the pseudo-scientific name of partial birth abortion, was struck down by a one-vote margin. 30 state laws were affected by this decision, as well as congressional efforts to enact similar federal legislation. So there was a lot at stake in this decision, and there's a lot at stake in maintaining that 5-4 majority. Now, the Supreme Court is one thing, but the fact of the matter is that as long as the Republican Party controls Congress, civil liberties and civil rights will be in serious jeopardy from a legislative standpoint. I should add that as long as the Republican Party configured as it currently is, parties change over time, but for the foreseeable future, the Republican Party as a party is very hostile to most civil liberties. The House Judiciary Committee, which has primary jurisdiction over many of these issues, is stacked with right-wing ideologues. The Republican lineup on the committee reads like a civil liberties version of America's Most Wanted. There can be no clearer example of the Republican disdain for the rights of religious minorities than the debate over the use of public institutions to spread religious messages or of public dollars to aid religious activities. The Republicans are dismayed that the Ten Commandments aren't posted in every classroom and courtroom in America. They would be perfectly happy fully integrating church and state. I think it's important to get back to basics and ask, why do we insist on the separation of church and state? Is it to protect government from religion, as the proponents of breaching the wall of separation often argue? Not at all. It's really to protect religion from government. I am amazed that many of my conservative colleagues who do not trust the government to protect the environment or to build new schools in our communities or to impose and enforce consumer protection regulations are perfectly willing to turn over to government bureaucrats the power to enforce their moral and religious views on our children. Recall the 1998 so-called Istook Amendment, the proposed religious liberty amendment to the Constitution, a proposed constitutional amendment that garnered well over a majority of the votes in the House, but thankfully fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to begin the process of amending the Constitution. This amendment represents a radical departure from our constitutional framework. The First Amendment prohibits any law respecting an establishment of religion, the so-called Establishment Clause. The Istook rewrite would substitute a prohibition only of establishing any official religion. That is a significant narrowing of the First Amendment and gives the government broad new rights to meddle in religion. Anything short of establishing an official church which favors one religion over all others would now be allowed. Some of the language of the proposed amendment is telling. It refers to the right of the people, in quotes, in religious affairs, the right of the group, of the collective majority. That is very contrary to our tradition. Religious liberty in our nation has always been an individual, not a collective right. By consistently referring to the people's right to bring their religious beliefs and heritage onto public property, the amendment would negate the important principle that real religious liberty cannot belong to the collective. It must belong to individuals and families. Unfortunately, there are many people in this country who think they have the right to use the advantage of the majority and the power of government to coerce or pressure others into engaging in their prayer, or at the very least, to single out and embarrass the minority that refuses to do so. Take, for example, the celebrated case of Judge Roy Moore in Alabama, who posted the Ten Commandments in his courtroom. Actually, of course, it is no more his courtroom than my taxpayer-funded congressional office is my office. Both offices belong to the people, in his case of the state, in my case of the United States. Judge Moore also invites a Protestant minister to lead newly impaneled juries in a Protestant prayer. Why a Protestant prayer? Well, Judge Moore has said, quote, there are no Muslims in Etowah County, unquote, although the Atlanta Constitution reports that, in fact, there are quite a few. He also told ABC's 2020 that, quote, this country was founded not upon Buddha, not upon Hinduism, not upon a Muslim belief, but upon the belief in the God of the Holy Scripture, close quote. Now, why should we object to Judge Moore's activities? After all, most of us were raised to revere the Ten Commandments. The simple answer is that this situation involves religious coercion. No one enters Judge Moore's courtroom voluntarily. Not the jurors who were summoned to the court on pain of contempt. not a defendant or litigant who must be there, and not the attorneys who work there. They are subject to the will of the judge in his exercise of the power delegated to him by the government. And Judge Moore has decided to use the power of government to advance his personal religious beliefs and to subject everyone in that courtroom to those personal religious beliefs. How would I, were I in his courtroom, as a member of the Jewish faith, fare in his courtroom? What would be my choices? Well, I could remain in the court but violate my religious beliefs by participating in the Protestant prayer, or I could leave or simply remain seated during the prayer. But should I risk prejudicing my case or the case of my client, if I were an attorney, by separating myself so visibly from the Protestant community of faith from the majority in that courtroom? I suppose if winning the case was very important to me, I could simply swallow my faith and the faith of my family and join in, especially since my rights or those of my client are hanging in the balance in that courtroom. That's a very nice choice. The point is that this is a terrible abuse of power. It allows the judge to send a message that certain people are not really a part of the community, that they are at best tolerated outsiders who do not share the faith of the majority. The courts have rightly ruled that Judge Moore's practices violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. But the Istook Amendment would legalize Judge Moore's actions. They would legalize his posting the Ten Commandments. They would legalize his leading a Protestant prayer or a Catholic prayer or a Jewish prayer as he exercised his political power to decide. The truth is that there is no need for a constitutional amendment to protect religious freedom. Today, or to protect the Establishment Clause, today children can pray in school privately under the, and as someone has said, there will always be prayer in the public schools as long as there are math tests. Under the Equal Access Act, children can organize Bible study groups in school. Religious charities administer millions of dollars in federal funds to perform good works, and the words of a multitude of denominations are heard over the airwaves. What is not permitted is the use of government power to coerce participation in a religious activity. That is the proper balance, and we imperil our most fundamental freedom if we dare disturb that balance. The Republicans are not content to try to knock down the wall of separation between church and state. They also want to impose a particular religious view of abortion on American women. They would be happy to see Roe versus Wade overturned tomorrow. They could care less about the health of the women, and despite the Supreme Court mandate to protect it, they imperil it with every abortion bill they introduced, and they have introduced many. They have introduced the Child Custody Protection Act, for example, which hasn't gotten a lot of publicity. This bill would make it illegal to accompany a minor across state lines to have an abortion if she lacked parental consent in the state she left, even if the state in which the abortion is performed does not require such consent. They want to give the first few cells following conception the full legal rights of developed human beings. They want us to change the official statistics of the Oklahoma bombing to include counting pregnant women twice. They have introduced the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, which is simply a backdoor attempt to create fetal personhood from the moment of conception in the criminal code. They have tried many times to pass a so-called partial birth abortion ban. They have continued these efforts even after the Supreme Court ruling in Stenberg versus Carhart decided earlier this summer. As you know, Carhart specifically struck down such a ban on the state level because the state law lacked an exception to protect a woman's health, because it imposed an undue burden on the right to choose, even pre-viability, and because it was so vague that doctors could not know what it was that the law prohibited. There is, in fact, no medical procedure called partial birth abortion. That is a polemical term invented by anti-choice propagandists. Nonetheless, we pass in every session a partial birth abortion bill in the Congress. The Republicans are so shameless that they want to protect even people who bomb abortion clinics. Some violent anti-choice groups have been subjected to large fines under the Freedom of Access to Clinics Entrances Act, which we call affectionately the FACE Act. They have been subjected to large fines for bombing abortion clinics or for violently interfering with women attempting to enter these clinics. They have declared that they will use the bankruptcy laws to escape their fines by declaring bankruptcy after they're assessed large fines for violent acts. So I propose an amendment to a pending bankruptcy bill to make such fines non-dischargeable, that is, not cancelable in bankruptcy. But the anti-choice forces in Congress are so strong that the amendment was not permitted to be debated or to have a vote on the floor of the House. Indeed, the anti-choice forces are so strong that their opposition to the Senate version of this amendment, introduced by Senator Schumer, is currently blocking the entire bankruptcy bill. In my opinion, it's a terrible bill, so it's not so terrible. And the Republicans are not hostile just to abortion rights. They are fervent opponents of equal rights for gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender individuals. Their anti-gay biases block passage of hate crime legislation each year, despite the overwhelming support for the measure in the Senate and probably in the House as well. Let me tell you a brief story to illustrate what we're faced with. While the hate crimes bill was pending in a House-Senate conference committee because it had been appended to a different bill passed by the Senate, I tried to rally members of the House to support the measure. I organized, along with some others, a letter to the conference committee signed by dozens of members of Congress. I spoke personally to Chairman Henry Hyde of the Judiciary Committee about the legislation. He tried to argue, and he's chairman also of the conference committee, he tried to argue that he opposed the bill because it punished thought. I pointed out that the existing laws already punish hate crimes based on intent, whether it be racial or religious, and that the proposed legislation simply extended the concept to crimes against people on the basis of sexual orientation. It's already forbidden, it's already punishable on the basis of race or religion. Then he told me flat out that he could not support the bill because he cannot support the, quote, homosexual lifestyle, close quote. I continued to argue with him, saying that even if he didn't approve of the, quote, homosexual lifestyle, did he really believe that gays deserve to be beaten to death just because they are gay? But he wouldn't listen, and the hate crimes bill is still stalled in the conference committee. The anti-gay attitudes have shows itself in many ways. Every year, members of Congress take to the floor to deliver the most hateful, homophobic tirades. Both houses of Congress passed the so-called Defense of Marriage Act. The Republicans never let a federal civil rights bill for gays see the light of day. They would like to fully ban gays from the military and prevent same-sex couples from adopting children or from receiving any kind of public or private benefits granted to heterosexual couples. In the realm of specific civil rights for same-sex couples, for example, I introduced a bill called the Permanent Partners Immigration Act. This bill would allow permanent partners to sponsor one another for immigration purposes. As you may know, it can be very difficult for binational same-sex couples to stay together, given our current immigration laws. Now, married couples are given specific rights in the immigration process to sponsor each other in order to keep their families together. But gay couples cannot do this. They can be kept permanently apart, one in the United States and one in some foreign country. The bill would add the term "or permanent partner" after the word "spouse" wherever the word "spouse" appears in the immigration and naturalization law. This bill has been received quite well and currently has 47 co-sponsors. Thanks to a lot of work by grassroots organizations, the word has gone out, and members of Congress are hearing about this bill from their constituents. We're very pleased with what has happened so far, and we will keep working to build support for this measure. But the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee can see this bill only as a backdoor approach to gay marriage. So thousands of couples will continue to be forcefully separated. And this is a gratuitous cruelty not worthy of a great nation. Finally, let me mention a threat to the right to privacy and to the Fourth Amendment posed by a new law enforcement technology applied to the Internet. The FBI's new Carnivore program allows the FBI to intercept and collect any electronic communications, including email. Here's how it works. The FBI gets a court order based on probable cause to monitor the content of an individual's communications. It then contacts the Internet Service Provider, the ISP, and asks it to isolate and transmit to the FBI all of that individual's email. If the ISP is unwilling or unable to do that, the FBI sets up a separate Carnivore machine that is connected to the computers of the ISP. Carnivore gives the FBI access to all traffic over the ISP's network, not just to communications to or from the target. Carnivore, which is capable of analyzing millions of messages per second, purportedly retains only the messages of a specified to and from the specified target. Although this selection takes place without the scrutiny of either the ISP or of any court, Carnivore permits access to the email of all customers of an ISP and to the email of every person who communicates with any customer of an ISP. Carnivore is roughly equivalent to a wiretap capable of accessing the contents of the conversations of all of the phone company's customers, with the assurance, in quotes, that the FBI will record only conversations of the specified target. This trust us, we are the government approach is the antithesis of the procedures under our current wiretapping laws and of the central concept of the Fourth Amendment, which is designed to protect our privacy. The wiretapping laws authorize limited electronic surveillance of the communications of specified persons, usually conducted by means of specified communications devices approved by a court after a showing of probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. The current wiretapping laws place on the provider of the communications medium the responsibility to separate communications authorized to be intercepted from all other communications. Law enforcement is normally required to minimize its interception of non-incriminating communications, even of a target of a wiretap order. Carnivore is not a minimization tool. Instead, Carnivore maximizes law enforcement's access to the communications of targets and of non-targets, indeed of everyone. It is far from clear that the Fourth Amendment allows the government to serve an order on an Internet service provider to obtain the email addresses of incoming and outgoing messages for a particular subscriber. Congress and the courts must act to ensure that the Fourth Amendment, which protects the right of the people, quote, to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, unquote, against unreasonable searches and seizures, is fully applied in the modern telecommunications context, and specifically in the context of the Internet. We must ensure that law enforcement agents do not use devices, are not allowed to use devices that allow access to electronic communications except those erected to a specified target for whom they have a proper court order, having shown probable cause of it to suspect that person of a crime. I've tried to outline some of the challenges to our cherished fundamental rights emanating from the courts, the Congress, and from state and local governments. The threats are real and the task daunting. Much damage has been done, and we will feel the consequences for many years to come. So the question arises with all of these issues, where do we go from here? How are we to achieve better protection of our civil liberties? If history has taught us nothing else, it has taught us that all Americans are one people joined together in a great national experiment to ensure that the rights and liberties of every individual are protected. A great civil war was fought to establish this truth. We are citizens of the United States, subject to the supreme law of the land. We have the same privileges and immunities throughout that land. Our rights and liberties are national rights and liberties and should be unalienable. They should not be suspended because a particular Congress or a particular administration thinks it expedient to do so. They are not divisible and cannot be enforced piecemeal, with certain rights protected only in certain states. Congress, as the representative of all of the people, has an important role to play in protecting, enforcing, and enhancing these liberties. And the courts must not weaken our constitutional protections by imposing a static and rigid concept of federalism upon the dynamic, personal, and life-sustaining development of these rights. I firmly believe that the next election will be decisive for many years to come on many of their questions. The administration that controls appointments to the federal courts and particularly to the Supreme Court, can stem this tide and make a difference, or it can promote the tide. This Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected Congress's use of various enumerated powers to legislate in favor of civil rights and civil liberties on the relatively few occasions when Congress has chosen to do so. It has substituted its own views on the necessity for various laws, on the adequacy of the legislative factual record, and on the appropriateness of the remedy crafted by Congress. It has restricted Congress' power under the 14th Amendment to fashion protections for religious freedom and civil rights. It has narrowed its interpretation of the Commerce Clause to prevent Congress from punishing handgun violence in our schools and reducing violence against women by permitting women to sue their attackers. It has proclaimed a newly expansive view of the rights of states by, for example, prohibiting state employees from suing the states for violation of the federal age discrimination or federal wage and hour laws. It is clear that while certain high-profile issues, such as the right to choose, must remain a high priority, no president can ignore the more arcane federalism issues, which must also receive careful attention in the selection and approval of Supreme Court justices. Any nominee to the Supreme Court who believes that Congress lacks the power under the Constitution to protect individual rights or the rights of working families should be viewed with suspicion and concern. The trend toward narrowing the scope of the Commerce Clause and of the 14th Amendment, as well as the reinvention of the 11th Amendment, are examples of structural changes in our form of government that the Court has and could continue to make, which would have disastrous and far-reaching effects. We cannot afford the continuation of these assaults on our rights. The present Court, in its haste to refight the Civil War and revive the states' rights doctrine, has forgotten about the Civil War-era amendments adopted to provide a national guarantee of individual rights. Depending on the outcome of this November's election, we may or may not have the opportunity to address the civil liberties challenges before us. Control of Congress is vital because with it comes the power to appoint all the committee and subcommittee chairs and to set the agenda. Which bills are considered, which amendments get a vote, which issues get a hearing. That is a very significant reason to consider party affiliation when evaluating different candidates. If Democrats are in control of Congress, protection of abortion rights, protection of religious freedom, and of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights will be on the congressional agenda. Instead of having 30 hearings on bills to subvert Roe versus Wade or on phony issues like partial birth abortion, we will have hearings and investigations aimed at ending discrimination, punishing hate crimes, and protecting the due process rights of immigrants and innocent people accused of heinous crimes. A net change of 6 seats in the House is all it would take. While Congress can set the agenda, very little legislation can be enacted into law without the consent of the President. Thankfully, the worst efforts of the Republican extremists in control of the Congress have not been enacted into law because a Democratic president still wields the veto power. If that were to change, and if Congress were to remain in the hands of the Republicans, who knows what havoc they could wreak together? I fear the consequences for civil liberties and for our nation as a whole. Civil liberties, civil rights, the rights of women, the protection of the environment, and the rights of working people have been under attack for many years, from the Supreme Court, the Republican Congress, and a few years ago, the Reagan-Bush White House. Luckily, we have not faced in the last 4 decades a Republican president and Congress at the same time. We cannot afford a White House and a Congress that are indifferent or hostile to the rights of most Americans. We cannot afford the domination of a political party that, despite the diversity on display at its convention, is still committed to using racial division to achieve its ends. And we cannot afford the Supreme Court they would leave as their legacy. If we are to avoid these calamities, all those who share a similar concept of justice, liberty, and equality must work together. Sometimes there will be friction beyond within that grand coalition. But we must not be diverted by these frictions from our common purpose, to expand our concept of liberty and to ensure that everyone is encompassed within that conception of liberty. The liberty of future generations depends on us in this generation. Thank you very much.
Congressman Nadler, thank you very much. If you'll return to the podium here, we have a whole host of questions. We'll try to get in as many as we can in the remaining time. As you can imagine, the decision yesterday by Vice President Gore is foremost in many people's ideas. So let's run a few on that one. Please comment on the Senator Joseph Lieberman choice. Is America ready for a Jewish vice president, or is this even a question on which we should focus?
Well, let me take that in reverse order. It's obviously a question on which we're going to focus whether we should or not. So there's no point in discussing whether we should think about it because people are going to think about it. Yes, I think America is very ready for a Jewish vice president. It's interesting what the polling data tells us. They tell us that you ask the question, would you be willing to vote for a candidate otherwise qualified in your opinion who is Jewish for president? In the 1940s, the answer, the percent who answered yes was 40-something percent. Currently, it's 92% who say yes. Now, it may be that not everybody's telling the truth. Racial and religious pioneers, that is to say people who run for office as the first of their group, sometimes find that the polls are not accurate. Governor Wilder, the first African-American governor of Virginia, won by about 1%. The polls had him ahead by 13%. So 12% of the people, assuming those polls were methodologically accurate, couldn't bring themselves to tell a pollster what they really thought. But nonetheless, 92% say yes. And the fact is, if you look, we have Jewish members in Congress from areas where they may be the only Jews in the district. Dan Glickman is now the Secretary of Agriculture, represented for many years a district in Kansas. I don't know what the Jewish percentage of the Kansas population is, but it isn't very high. We have two Jewish senators, both senators from Wisconsin, of all places, are Jewish. How many Jews, what percentage of the population are there in Wisconsin? I don't think very high. So I think most people will vote on the merits regardless of the fact that people are Jewish. I think something else, too. When John Kennedy ran as the first Catholic candidate, or the first candidate who happened to be Catholic, he didn't run as the Catholic candidate. When he ran as the first candidate who was Catholic, or the second, actually, Al Smith, very different reception. But in 1960, when he ran as the first successful candidate who was Catholic, it was a big issue. He had to talk to the Greater Houston Ministerial Association, assure people he wasn't the Pope's agent, he wouldn't take orders, and so forth. And he was elected. And the issue disappeared. When Ed Muskie was a candidate 8 years later, no one mentioned the fact that he was Catholic. I'm not sure anybody thought about it. Ronald Reagan, plenty of pros and cons in Reagan, but did anybody mention he was Catholic? Just the issue totally disappeared very rapidly. I think the issue, especially if Gore and Lieberman are elected, the issue will disappear very rapidly. I think the United States, as demonstrated by its very rapidly diminishing anti-Semitism, is manifested in a million different ways over the last 30 or 40 years, and as demonstrated by the large number of Jewish public officials compared to the Jewish population percentage, has demonstrated that it's really not a great barrier today.
Follow on to that, will Joe Lieberman's nomination decrease or increase anti-Semitism?
I don't think his nomination will increase or decrease anti-Semitism. I think it'll probably bring out more anti-Semitic statements from people who are already anti-Semitic. I think you'll hear more statements like that. We saw a flurry on the internet. It will be an occasion for more comment of anti-Semites and people responding to anti-Semites. But his nomination per se, I don't think will have any bearing on increasing or decreasing it.
A question now on the Supreme Court. How do you think the Rehnquist Court will go down in history?
That's interesting. The Rehnquist Court, I think, will go down in history, first of all, as an activist court. Republicans and conservatives in general are always telling us that we ought to have strict constructionists who do not impose their own ideas, etc. But the Rehnquist Court, people like Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, even Kennedy sometimes, are very activist judges. They're not activists in the same direction as Warren or Black or Douglas or Brennan, but they're very activists, as some of the examples I gave in my remarks demonstrate. They're activists in the sense of willing to break precedent, to go where they want to go. Activists in the sense of willing to overturn congressional mandates that they do not approve of. Activists in imposing their will. That's what an activist court means, and not deferring to the will of the democratically elected branches. It will go down in some ways as a reactionary court. I mentioned the Bowers versus Hardwick decision, which said that it's perfectly okay. The consensual sodomy laws, even in the privacy of one's bedroom, are constitutional. They're not a violation of the privacy rights of the Fourth and other amendments. It has embarked on this whole narrowing of the Commerce Clause. In the context of history, that's very notable. You remember the switch in time that saved nine? During the Roosevelt administration, after consistently for the first 4 or 5 years throwing out as unconstitutional every New Deal law, every economic law, and even before the Roosevelt administration, you can't have a minimum wage law. That's a violation of freedom of contract, and that's beyond the Congressional Commerce Clause power. You can't have any of these public welfare laws. I don't mean welfare in the more narrow sense, but public welfare laws, economic regulation laws. And in 1937 or 38, they switched, and they started declaring these laws constitutional. They started more broadly reading the Commerce Clause. And I don't think that from 1938 until 1995, any law was declared unconstitutional as beyond the power of Congress to enact under the Commerce Clause. Since the Lopez decision in 1995, they started down the road, 5-4, same five justices in, I think, five or six decisions by now in the last 5 years to increasingly narrow the reading of the Commerce Clause. How far they will go, whether they'll go all the way back to Lochner in 1905 or not, or to the pre-New Deal court, one doesn't know, but that's a very reactionary direction. To narrow Congress' ability to enforce the 14th Amendment guarantees of due process of law, not depriving people of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, to narrow Congress' power to enforce that by legislation, they've set the stage for declaring the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 unconstitutional. The logic of the Bernie decision in which they declared the Religious Freedom Restoration Act unconstitutional would, if applied, kill the 64 and 65 Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts. Whether they'll go that far remains to be seen, but that's the direction they're going in.
Do you believe that there are moral issues that a pregnant woman should consider in deciding whether to give birth or to elect to have an abortion? Or is this decision morally neutral?
I certainly believe there are moral issues that a pregnant woman should consider, and that she might want to talk to her priest or minister or rabbi or doctor or husband or boyfriend to get their judgments too. But ultimately, it's her judgment. There are clearly moral issues, and they're very great moral issues. I have always been pro-choice because I have always believed that these are very severe, large moral issues, but that the state has no right to dictate the moral decision to the woman. There are various of our great religions that take different moral views, and they may be valid religious views, and these religious groups have every right to try to persuade people and their own adherents to abide by them. But for example, the Catholic Church thinks that that a person becomes a person at conception. Some Protestant groups think it 40 days after conception. Judaism has different answers. I forget exactly when. But these are religious concepts. The state has no business, the government has no business imposing someone's religious or moral judgment on the woman. Now, I think that the Roe versus Wade decision, in one respect, was very well crafted, in one respect, not so well crafted. The respect in which it was well crafted was that it did say, because there is an inherent tension here, it did say that the state at the outset of pregnancy, basically in the first trimester, has no right to regulate it at all, and has no right to deal, to impose state will in any way on the mother, on the woman's judgment, on her moral judgments. In the second trimester, it said, or pre-viability, but in the second, well, I don't know, in the second trimester, basically it said, the state has some right to regulate at the margins, but it's still her decision. And in the third trimester, it said, the state has more interest in an almost fully formed human, and therefore has the right to ban it, to ban abortion, except where necessary for the health or life of the mother. That's the Roe v. Wade decision, basically. And in saying that the state has, that there's a spectrum, and that at 9 months the state has more of a right to have something to say than earlier, I think that's the right direction. I think the court made a mistake because it didn't understand modern science in basing it on viability, basing anything on viability, because viability, namely the ability to live outside the womb, is going to change as technology improves. And eventually we will come to the point where you can have a conception in vitro, where you take a sperm and an egg in a test tube and unite them and carry that fetus to term to become a baby without ever being inside a woman at all. So there's a technological problem within Roe v. Wade, but which they'll have to correct at some point. But the basic thrust of it, I think, is a very valid one. There, and to summarize, yes, there are very real moral issues, but the key is that it's not up to the government and it's not up to the majority of the people. It's up to nobody has the right to dictate those moral choices to the woman involved.
Unfortunately, we've come to that point in our program where we have time for just one last question. And that question is, will your beloved Yankees represent the American League in this year's World Series?
I believe God is just, and therefore the answer is yes.
On that note, our thanks to the Honorable Gerald Nadler, United States Congressman from New York, for joining us this evening. We also thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, as well as those listening on radio. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and Planned Parenthood is adjourned.